Los Fanboys, episode 39.
Bienvenidos and welcome to Los Fanboys, the official movie and TV podcast of LRM Online. You are currently listening to the velvety tones of one Mario Francisco Robles, right? Am I velvety today, guys? Am I not like as sick as I've been?
You know, give me about 10 minutes to listen to you and I'll be able to answer it. You won't be sniffing as much, that's for sure.
I think I'm pretty velvety. So as you just heard, that was Joseph Jammer Medina.
Yo.
And, of course, we got Kelvin Chavez.
Yo.
Wow. Yo. That delay this time was intense.
You went for an epic delay on that one.
I thought maybe he fell down an open manhole or something.
To come back with the epic delays.
Yeah, apparently. So we're here today with this 39th edition of our wonderful podcast, which continues to get glowing reviews with our beautiful 5-star rating on iTunes, and we're just doing wonderfully thanks to you. So thanks for keeping the love coming. We'll get to those reviews in a bit. But Medina, Jammer, you know, how do you want to start us off?
Well,
I always let you be the crossing guard. You know that.
Well, speaking of crossing guard, actually, there's no transition there. We're just going to go straight into our question of the week from last week.
Okay.
Our question of the week. If you recall, the Beauty and the Beast trailer dropped. I believe you guys were kind of fans of it. I was less so. I liked it, but at the same time, I didn't like the fact that it leaned so heavily on what we had seen in the original animated movie. So those were my thoughts. But we want to know your thoughts. So you guys took to Twitter, or a few of you did, and with the hashtag LosFanboys, and answered the question. So what did they have to say, Mario?
Well, we got Aaron Varola, who seemed to agree with both Kelvin and I on the good and the bad of the piece in terms of, he says, yeah, I'll check out Beauty and the Beast, you know, the movie when it comes out. He said it sparked nostalgia, similar to what it did with me. But he agrees with Kelvin that the CGI looked a little rough. He said that the Beast's face was kind of hard to read, and he hoped he can emote in the scenes that matter. So there he sort of agrees with both Kelvin and I. Then we've got Tavo Borrego, who said he was disappointed with the Beauty and the Beast trailer. Felt like I was watching the animated movie. So Tavo is in Team Jammer there.
Damn right.
And by the way, Tavo had personally directed me, tweeted at me, by the way, that he was sorry about forgetting to mention me in the review he wrote for us. So no hard feeling, Tavo. Todo está bien, okay? Todo está bien. Then Sean said, don't care about the Beauty and the Beast, and neither does my wife, so I will not have anyone dragging me to it. The cast is great, though, so when it's on TV, I'll give it my time because of that. CGI better improve, though. So, yeah, all right. So he also doesn't seem to be impressed like Jammer, and he has his concerns about the CG like Kelvin. So it seems like everyone's responses sort of like ran the gamut of what the three of us felt. And that was about it.
I think that goes to show that between the three of us, we're right.
Yeah, between the three of us, there's a consensus in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, Twitter user Dan Barley, at Barley Boy, you know, you teased us, but you never actually gave us your answer to the question. You tweeted, you said something about, now to think of this week's answer, I'll try to keep it succinct. Well, buddy, you kept it so succinct that it doesn't exist.
You called him
Dan,
out.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, like, I want to know what he thinks.
I know he's can I just listen to the podcast like everyone else and not have to interact?
No, I want interaction. I want to make friends.
Okay.
Anyway. And since I did mention the reviews earlier, we got a couple of new ones, everybody.
Sweet.
So we got a couple of new ones on iTunes by user Lemon Pudding Pop, which, by the way, this one is like probably our most random review to date. There's a couple of references that went right over my head, but we'll go for it. The name of the review is No Tapatio Sauce Needed. And then he wrote, "They aren't bad hombres. They cover the trending topics in movie news. You won't be disappointed listening to them. Eating elote with mayo, on the other hand, though, dot, dot, dot." No idea what that means, but thank you for the five-star review. Then Alexis Spain, and this was kind of cool because this is one of our international listeners, it seems, wrote, "Awesome. I found this podcast some time ago, and after listening to several episodes, I can say that Los Fanboys is a fantastic way to get the latest news related to movies and series. What I like the most is that all of its three components share different points of view in a climate of respect." Well, sometimes they swear a little bit, but that's okay. "The program is really well done and structured. I hope you guys can keep doing the great job. Saludos from a Spanish listener." So you hear that? They like us. They really like us.
I'll take it whenever I can get it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we know that about you. So, mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to move on to one of our, you know, our basically our usual show starter, the box office.
So this was a pretty good week. Well, I guess good in the sense of, we'll see. We'll discuss it. Number one, A Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them with $74.4 million. This is pretty much smack dab in the middle of more conservative expectations for the film. I think those were around 70 to 80, but I think at heart, Warner Brothers kind of wanted $85 million, give or take. So I think it may have shot on the lower end of expectations, but that being said...
Yeah, by the way, hang on. I'm sorry, just real quick, because there are actuals that came in after that. The actuals make it really 74. Because it was like 74.4, not 75. So it's 74.
I did say that.
Why did you say that when it says 75 in the report?
I'm looking at a Box Office Mojo actual report.
Oh, so then you're just much smarter than I am, and I'm sorry I cut you off. God, I'm an awful person.
That's
what happened to our climate of respect? Keep going, Jammer.
So yeah, $74.4 million, which is, like I said, not too bad. Not as great as they wanted it to be, I'm sure, because, you know, it has the weight of Harry Potter to it, and I think they were hoping for a little bit better, but... I don't think we should ring the bell of disappointment just yet, which we'll talk about that in a bit once we can get deeper into that. But at number two, we had Doctor Strange still hanging in there, and this is its third week, and compared to last week, it drops less than 60%, which is actually kind of impressive. It was 58.7% for a total of $7.76 million for the weekend. Its total gross domestically is $181.6 million. And as far as worldwide totals, it is $572 million. So it is almost at $600 million. And I'm not sure if it's going to slow down anytime soon. At the end of the day, it might even hit $700 million. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, that's an area where I tend to be a little hazy. When we get like several weeks out, I don't really know how to gauge a film's legs. I usually, you know, my gauge for that sort of thing ends at like weekend two. Mm-hmm. So I'm really not sure. I mean, to me, just as a total sort of non box office, mathematician type person, mm-hmm. that sounds very optimistic that it could still, that you think it can make another $100 million at this stage of the game. That to me, that sounds a little, out there, but listen, I'm not an expert by any stretch at this point of the game. So, you know,
that's
all I'll say on that.
Well, I know Suicide Squad ended up doing really well when its box office run.
Yeah.
It was like 5 million away from matching, well, this is domestically, from matching Batman v Superman's domestic, which is really impressive.
At this stage of the game, or like, how does that compare to this?
It compares to in that Suicide Squad managed to have legs despite the fact that it had terrible reviews, whereas this one seems to have held up much better at the front end, and it has fantastic reviews.
And fantastic
word of mouth. With Suicide Squad, there was nothing to compete with.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. Doctor Strange is about to, you know, head into a very crowded market, especially with Moana looking to come out and destroy the world when it comes out on Friday.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on. Trolls, $17.4 million, dropped 50%. Still hanging in there. Not doing amazing, but doing pretty solid. The budget was $125 million. So far, worldwide, it's made $262.3 million. I'm expecting it probably to get around $300 million when all said and done. I don't think this is necessarily... a huge win for them, but it's definitely like, hey, you know, probably going to make money when all said and done, which is always good news. And
also, it's going to have all that merchandising, all the toys.
Exactly. That's where the real shit is made. And I think Trolls was especially – I'm surprised that they managed to make Trolls not just as good of a movie as it was, but they managed to make those dolls not atrocious with the redesign in the show, the movie. They look so much more appealing now than they did, you know, growing up, where they just looked ugly as fuck. I didn't understand the appeal of those dolls. But, you know. Whatever, I guess I'm not a little girl, so... Were they girl things or are they guy things, too? I don't even know. Does anybody know?
We're all both.
They're both?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never got into Trolls, so there you go.
Neither did I.
Arrival.
Me neither.
Was at number 4. And hanging in there, it's at $54 million worldwide. And it had a production budget of $47 million, so it just recouped its budget. But as we know, those are not necessarily the most of the costs. You know, there's the marketing budget, which the general rule of thumb is to double the production budget. But, you know, we don't know really how much it is. So when all said and done, if it breaks $100 million, I call it a success. If not, it's still an amazing movie, but I really hope it makes its money back. It was a great movie. I saw that. I'm not sure I talked about it last week. Did I mention that I saw the movie?
Yes, you did.
I did? Okay. So I'm not going to talk about it again.
I don't know. I'm feeling a little skeptical about its prospects of getting to 100, and it seems like it needs to get to 100 to be a success for Paramount. So I'm not sure. Like at this rate, you know, if it's at 11 now, it's going to be at like, you know, 6 or 7 next week, and then, you know, it's going to fall off the radar by Christmas.
Yeah.
Especially like what Calvin said, we're about to get all this competition. I don't know, man.
Paramount has some good competition coming out, though. They have some good shit coming out.
I know, but in terms of, you know, trying to recoup what they did for Arrival, I'm not sure how that's going to work out for them.
Yeah, I think the problem – go ahead.
No, because I said Paramount has, like, Fences coming out and – this one, the one Silence, you know, so they're both Oscar worthy, and people already seen Fences, and the word of mouth already is that is, you know, Oscar material no matter what. And so is Silence.
Is it right?
Even though you said it's caca.
Yeah, dude, that's 3 hours long, you know, it's like,
Is it boring? Is it like the, God, what was it? The Mission? Was that the name of that Robert De Niro
film? No, to be honest, because, you know, I knew a while back that it was 3 hours long, but now they wanted to cut it down. So who knows? They might have cut it down to less than 3 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think you mentioned this last week, or you definitely mentioned this last week, the whole cinema score for Arrival being a B. I think the B was maybe a victim of expectation. I don't know why people expected something different than what the movie ended up being. But that probably did not help. Do you know, Kelvin, if Arrival is an Oscar contender in any way?
I don't think so. Like I said before, I liked it. You liked it.
But I loved it.
Right? Okay. So people who – and I don't know if you agree with this, but I compared it to Interstellar.
Yeah.
If you like Interstellar, you're going to like Arrival.
Yeah.
And my two boys went to see Arrival, and I told, you know, if you like Interstellar – I know one, my oldest son did not like Interstellar.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, when he came back, he didn't like the film. But my other one, he loved it too, because he liked Interstellar. But that whole thing about the comm score being a B or whatnot, look, I saw a movie this weekend that got an A on comm score, and it didn't attract moviegoers.
Are you talking about Edge of 17?
Edge of 17, which is fucking, it was a great fucking movie. Like literally, I was like, wow, that was
that opened on the dumbest fucking weekend for that. That it could have opened on.
And I'm like, wow, this is like one of those, you know, Howard Hughes type of, not, well, you know.
Did you
one
mean
of those,
John Hughes?
John Hughes or what's that name of that movie that I loved a lot? Not 16 Candles.
X-Men Apocalypse with all the heart.
Breakfast Club.
Pretty in Pink or some Breakfast kind Club. Of wonderful. Breakfast, nah. Yeah, something like that. But it was great. It was a great, great fucking movie. And it was packed. Sold out when I went. You know? And getting an A and still not performing well, you know, well.
Well, the thing about it is I think it all has to do with expectation versus what actually is met. You know, Edge of 17, unfortunately, the people going into it are probably going to like it because they're probably into sort of an indie or indie comedy drama type thing, and that's probably what they got. But at the end of the day, that doesn't necessarily mean that that has a huge appeal. It just has a huge appeal to the type of people who are going to see that movie. So
the problem
is it has a huge appeal to the women. You know,
does it?
Yes, but 70% of the women. But see, there's a problem that you're overlooking, Calvino, which is, you know, that movie was supposed to open at the end of September and in a much less crowded sort of area, and it might have done much better.
It would have, instead, because there was nothing
Fantastic
good.
Fantastic Beasts, yeah. Instead of the opening against Fantastic Beasts, and both are basically kind of pulling at teen audiences.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
is that the audience for Edge of 17?
This one pulls more towards a female audience, and the age is between 17 and 34. I mean, at least that's what my friend told me from ComScore.
I just, there was bound to be a lot of cannibalization here, because I'm sure a lot of teenagers who might have gone to see Edge of 17 on a quieter weekend were like, yo, let's go check out Fantastic Beasts. You know what I mean?
But what about, okay, so then what about, let's say, Bleed for This also got an A?
Once again, yeah,
no one wants to see that shit either.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. To me, the marketing on that sucks. Hasn't really...
Well, the thing is that,
I think the marketing for these two films was really bad.
Yeah. Well, the thing about, like, going back to what you said about the cinema score, once again, the cinema score is pointless if the audience that is going to see it and who grades it is like, limited. Like, for example, if there's a really, really, really specific type of demographic a movie is pointing to, and they all see the movie and they all love it, cinema score is A, but that doesn't mean the audience is huge. So I think there's sort of the difference there.
And I also think that the rating should come out like a few days before the film actually comes out. You know, so people at least know, oh, this cinema score gave it this.
Yeah, I think it's hard to get the general audience's perspective on it, though, if the movie...
Not really. You know why? You know why I say not really? Because if they're smart enough, they will go to these promo screenings, because every film, except if it's a fucking piece of shit caca film, they always have a promo screening all the time. And then they said usually on a Wednesday or on a Tuesday night or Wednesday night, is always around that time, they can go and do the thing there, and then just put it out on Thursday and say, hey, listen, this is what CinemaScore gave it a day before. They can
that's
easily...
the thing, though. I think that actually flies in the face of what CinemaScore is supposed to be. You know, CinemaScore is supposed to be not
that's
critics,
the general
not
audience,
the people.
That. That's
general
the general audience.
Audience
who's going to see
the general, it. Like, general audience is not going to seek out these exclusive screenings. That's not general audience.
No,
that's
it's
movie
not
junkies.
An exclusive screening.
Junkies
it's
are going to see these kinds of at the promo screenings. So you're going to get skewed responses.
It's not a media screening.
Okay, if I'm Joe Schmo who works at a freaking bakery every single day, I'm not going to be searching for promo screenings. I'm going to be trying to make money to put food on the table. Whereas if I'm Joe Film Critic, I'm probably going to be there. Or Joe Film Fan, you know, who happens to really like it as like an extensive hobby. Maybe I'll go check him out, but that doesn't necessarily make my perspective more valid because I'm not necessarily the general public. I'm someone who is well-versed in film.
Yeah, I'm with Jammer on this. You can't really do the cinema score thing earlier because the whole point is you base it on how people respond to it during those first couple of days where you get the actual huge sample size of general moviegoers. That's how you determine a cinema score. You're not going to be able to determine an accurate cinema score based on promo screenings and test screenings. So, Kelvin, he dicho. No.
I want to get back to Arrival really quick because I think my point was lost in the shuffle.
As for an Oscar for Arrival, it could get something else.
Well, my point about that, I think it could be Best Picture nomination, and it could be Amy Adams' Best Actress nomination. I'm not sure. Maybe Best Director for Villeneuve.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
It is. But my point is that even if it's not necessarily going to win anything, if it's in the running at all, it could prolong.
Well,
Kelvin.
I agree with you on the Best Picture.
Right. So it could. My point is, it could prolong its theater run and maybe recoup that cost. Is my point that I was trying to get to?
And it could be a dark horse.
You're right on that one.
Yes. Just think about what freaking Mad Max, what was that? Fury Road? No, that was one of the old ones. Yeah,
no,
Fury Road.
It. Yeah.
So when Fury Road came out, like, it was one of those where, like, the critics loved it. It didn't do amazing at the box office, but it did end up, you know, being considered a hit after Oscars took it seriously and it won a whole bunch of awards, and now it's looked upon very fondly in every regard. But the movie was not, like, a huge runaway box office success either.
No, it wasn't. So, It like barely made back its budget, if that.
Yeah, so it might, you know, Arrival could get that sort of push around award season as well. But I think the bigger story here in the box office, what we sort of need to move towards, is Fantastic Beasts.
Yes.
And what people within the industry are saying about it, and some notable stuff that seems to be, you know, that's just sort of making the rounds right now. Now, something I wrote about is the fact that, yes, $74 million is a nice, strong number. $74 million gave it the number one spot at the box office. $74 million is nothing to sneeze at. But $74 million might not be what Warner Brothers was really hoping for. And that's what people are talking about. That's what, like, you know, on Deadline, where they interviewed and spoke to some people off the record, some industry, like, you know, distribution chiefs and people like that from other studios. They say that a movie of this nature that had this much hype around it and that was connected to, you know, a freaking monolith like the Harry Potter franchise, Warner Brothers probably was hoping for something north of 90. And, you know, especially because the actual cost, when you factor in the budget, when you factor in the promotional cost, it's rumored that the film actually cost between $330 and $350 million.
And really quick, before we get into, like, I did some poor man's math on this, and taking into rough account the theater chains and their take, this movie would need to make north of $520 million to be profitable.
Okay. I'm not sure where you came up with that, but we'll go with it. So, you know, 74 mil is not, you know, it's just, you know, an anonymous distribution chief said, you know, they can't be happy about this internally because it does have a very hefty price tag. And when you look at, like, you know, what Doctor Strange did only 2 weeks ago, that one made like $84 million, and Doctor Strange is like a very sort of obscure character. And then, you know, this one is connected to Harry Potter. And, you know, it's just, it seems like maybe it was a problem with the marketing. Maybe it was, you know, something happened here where Warner Brothers sort of missed the mark, where this could have been a much bigger deal than it ended up being. And the talk is that, you know, there is some cause for concern, and that's what comes to these reports that are making their rounds today, that moving forward, they're actually going to be de-emphasizing Newt Scamander, that's Eddie Redmayne's character, and putting more focus on Dumbledore, who we knew was going to be there, and his relationship with Grindelwald. And these are two very big characters in the Harry Potter mythology. So it seems like whereas this first film had only loose connections and they didn't even want to like put Harry Potter anywhere in the title, kind of like how Rogue One is a spinoff, but it still says a Star Wars story. They could have found a way to tie this more towards Harry Potter, but they didn't. It looks like for the sequels, they are going to move full-fledged in a like Harry Potter prequel sort of direction. And I find that sort of thing fascinating because it's like if you were going to do that, if that was your plan all along, which I'm arguing it wasn't, why didn't you play up the Harry Potter connection sooner? You know, so to me, this whole idea that now they're going to start moving away from Eddie Redmayne and making Newt Scamander, you know, not the heart of the films, to me, that's very telling of how Warner Brothers feels about Fantastic Beasts and where to find them and where these five films are going to take us moving forward.
I'm going to have to disagree with you on that on a couple for a couple of reasons. So in the months leading up to Fantastic Beasts release, you know, we found out that the film would not just be a trilogy. We found out it would be a five film series. People were like, why? And J.K. Rowling says, once you figure out the story we're actually trying to tell with this, I think you'll understand why it's five films. This to me hints to the fact that once she started writing the story and started, you know, connecting the pieces, she realized, oh, this could connect in a much bigger way than I initially anticipated. The story expands to five films. And, you know, where Newt Scamander is definitely probably going to be in it, you know, that's not necessarily to say he's going to be the absolute focus. I got that impression while watching this movie that he would be, you know, in the films, but not necessarily the sole focus. It's going to slowly shift towards, as you mentioned, more Harry Potter connections. And I don't think, also, she already has a second draft of the second movie in script form. And I don't necessarily think this is a last minute pivot from Warner Brothers. J.K. Rowling is also the one who's sort of, you know, guiding the story, and I don't think she would be bullied into shifting her point of the story because this is her world, as much as you'd think. So that is my perspective. Also, worth noting that I just want to clarify what I did with the numbers there is that I took it. I did a rough calculation that the box office or the theaters would take around 30-ish%. Obviously, it's different for each movie, and it's different week to week because as a movie is out longer, I think the theater gets more and more. But starting out, I think studios usually get a much bigger chunk of it. So just to compensate, I did it around 30%. Taking that into account, plus the marketing budget and the production budget, around $520+ million is what I gather they would need to break even. But once again, that's just poor man's math. That's not even completely accurate. That's a ballpark.
Yeah, and mind you, no one's arguing that it's not going to be a hit. I especially with the international figures, I think this thing is going to make back its money and then some. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be another one of these instances where Warner Brothers was hoping for something, you know, much bigger, and now they have to sort of, you know, now they're sort of like retooling a little bit.
What makes you say they're retooling besides the comments from the director?
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the comments from the producer. And I feel from David Heyman, not David Yates, you know, to me, it just seems a little bit strange that after all the effort that went into basically making this its own franchise and saying that it isn't really directly a prequel, but that it's like, you know, a spin-off series set within the same world, for them to suddenly put us directly into Potter territory, to me, feels like a few months ago, someone got a whiff at Warner Brothers that this thing was going to need a little help. So they're moving in that direction now. That's just, I can't shake that feeling.
Okay.
I agree with Mario there.
I don't know. If it wasn't for the comments from J.K. Rowling in the past few months already and the fact that she's had two drafts of a second movie script already, I would.
No, I hear you. And it sounds like, I'm not saying like, yeah, it wouldn't make sense. Like, you know, she couldn't have rewritten a new movie in the last 5 days, but I, you know how this stuff works. You know, the Warner Brothers, they have test screenings. They have all kinds of focus group stuff going on months and months in advance. Mm-hmm. Kind of like they did with Batman v Superman, where there was stuff about test screenings in December and January. And you started hearing how they were retooling there. So, you know, months before a movie comes out, Warner Brothers kind of has their finger on the pulse of what might happen. So I get the sense that a few months ago, they kind of started seeing what was, you know, the writing on the wall for how Fantastic Beasts was doing, what the interest level was like, and how people were feeling about it. And they started giving J.K. Rowling just dropping hints like, you know, it would be kind of cool if we could make sure the sequel is more linked to the Potterverse. I just kind of get that sense because to me, it's weird that Eddie Redmayne's face has been all over everything. He's the face of the franchise.
Yeah.
This whole Fantastic Beasts thing, he is the face. Every poster, every commercial, every trailer, everything has been about Newt Scamander, and this whole thing. And now all of a sudden, the producer's saying he's not going to be at the heart of the film and that the main players are going to be Dumbledore and Grindelwald. To me, that sounds like a studio or a production that is trying to shift gears.
I mean, Jammer, you saw the film, correct? Mm-hmm. Now, what Mario was just saying, that all of a sudden they're going to change it to focus on Dumbledore and so on. I think that was the first impression I got the moment I saw the film in the opening act.
Wait, what?
He's saying that they're going to focus on Dumbledore and whatever.
Yeah.
Right? Didn't you get that feeling that was going to happen the moment you saw the opening credits?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that to me, of him saying that, is no surprise. I mean, I've always said that this is a prequel. No matter how you see it, it was going to be a prequel no matter how anybody sees it. It was going to be a prequel leading up to Harry Potter. And the fact that they used a little theme song in the very beginning of that's, you know...
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's kind of a prequel, but it's also, I think, was what I think it did well was that you didn't necessarily have to know anything about Harry Potter in any capacity.
Exactly.
It stood alone.
This is all new.
But it will still tie in. It'll still tell its own story, and it won't really matter if you followed Harry Potter or not, but it will still tie in.
I feel like if you go back to the inception of the project, some of the earliest comments about it, it was, you know, there was a clear distinction being made where where the producers or Rowling were saying things to the effect of, this is not really a prequel. It's just set in the same world. It's not really, you know, it's not a Harry Potter movie. This is not a Harry Potter movie. You know, at its inception, this was going to be a total sort of spin-off venture that didn't have direct ties. And now all of a sudden, the ties could not be more direct.
Well, I think
the problem there is that they, you know, as a filmmaker, this has to be, you know, done way before. So they already knew long time ago that this was going to be a prequel. Yeah. It wasn't just like, oh, you know what? Shit, we fucked up. Let's cut the movie within a month and put this in. It's not going to happen. Yeah. They knew a long time ago this was going to be.
Yeah. I haven't seen the movie, so I don't, you know, so I can't really judge whether or not it seems like it was always heading in this direction.
The only reason I say that is because they took 6 months to film this film.
Yeah.
6 months. And then when I saw David Yates at the premiere, I asked him, another 6 months, maybe, or maybe not, you know,
for the second one.
For the second one, yeah, just to film.
So, okay, you know, you guys tell me this.
I feel like this is definitely the whole ties. They're very much embedded in the plot. You don't need to know that they connect to Harry Potter, but they are embedded in the plot. This does not seem like a last-minute panic move. This seems like 2 years ago, they said, oh, yeah, it's going to be a complete spinoff. But then as the project evolved, they realized, oh, we could actually make this something that's more unique and bigger. So, like, yes, it will tie together. No, you don't need to know the source material in order to actually appreciate it. But it does. It makes it a bit nicer.
Let me ask you this. Maybe this is more of a marketing snafu, but if it really was always going to be tied to the Harry Potter franchise, why didn't his name pop up anywhere on the poster?
I think they wanted it to stand on its own. I think they wanted to grab audiences.
But that's the thing. But why would you do that if you know what a gravy train Harry Potter is, and you're trying to make back money on a movie that you just said?
I think it was trying to
make over $500 million on.
I think maybe it was trying to set expectations.
So you're saying that if it would have said Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, semicolon, a Harry Potter story, it would have made more money.
Absolutely. Or even if you don't want, because that title is already such a fucking mouthful, even if just at the very top where it says, you know, from the makers of Harry Potter or from the world of Harry Potter, instead it mentions J.K. Rowling. Yeah, you know, it mentions J.K. Rowling and her wizarding world. But the words Harry Potter never pop up on that poster anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I think what they were trying to do was...
If I'm a promotional person, I'm finding ways to sneak that name in there.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you on the Harry Potter thing, but I think that they will go on with the route where let's not use his name and let's do, you know, the wand, the little light on the wand on the top, the wizarding world.
You know, that's something to do if this is more of like a modestly budgeted thing where you know you're going to be fucking riding a gravy train no matter what. But this thing was a fucking expensive endeavor that is meant to launch 5 films. So why wouldn't you, as a marketing team, as a PR firm, as a whatever the fuck you are, not try to find a way to be like, hey, everybody, this is a Harry Potter prequel?
I don't think wanted to set expectations in a certain way, because even though, yes, this is a prequel, yes, this is the same world, it does not feel like a Harry Potter movie. It feels like its own thing.
No, it doesn't.
And if they had put Harry Potter's name on it, I think a lot of people would have been disappointed because they would have been maybe even offended by the marketing, because it would have advertised it as a Harry Potter film, and it's not. It's its own beast, for lack of a better word.
It's his own movie. Yeah, it's his own movie.
So, like, I think they were trying to set the expectations, say, like, this is its own thing. Hopefully people will like it. And if they like it, it'll snowball into something bigger come second film. And I think this next weekend will be big at seeing, you know, whether or not this movie holds up. And then the big test will be, I think, Fantastic Beasts 2, to see how that is, you know, handled, how audiences respond to that.
And not only that, maybe shorten, like what Mario was saying, the name.
Such a mouthful. It'd probably just be Fantastic Beast 2. Yeah, a Harry Potter Fantastic Beast,
you know. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's going to be, I think Eddie Redmayne said, like, it'll be Fantastic Beast and blank.
Yeah.
That'll be, like, its naming
Fantastic
scheme.
Beast and the Dumbledore of box office.
But look, at the end of the day, Die Hard, I mean, I did. Are going to eat this. Die Hard Potter fans will eat this new material. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's to me, it was a good movie. A lot of nostalgia to the Potter world. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And please don't anyone think we're shitting on this movie or that I'm shitting. I haven't seen it yet, and I still plan on seeing it. Like, I'm actually excited for it. I just, you know, I'm just looking at this from sort of like a larger perspective as who, you know, who dropped the ball? Was it the marketing people, or did Warner Brothers actually have a change of heart about this movie and they want to, yeah, and that's why they're taking sort of a hard left towards the sequel? But yeah. I'm not shitting on this movie at all. I can't wait to see it. I love the Harry Potter movies, and I hope this thing does very well. I can't wait to see a sequel that delves into what, like, you know, the adventures of a young Dumbledore. So I'm in.
Well, for
so
me,
yeah, definitely. I
think that I'm like shitting on this.
This movie was pretty good. It was a bit slow pacing. Its characters were a bit flat. But I still enjoyed the film, and I was looking. I'm looking forward to see how they delve into those relationships down the line. So, like, it very much felt like while it was a standalone story, it felt like we're scratching the surface of all these characters. It didn't quite feel like they had as much depth to them as they, you know, the Harry Potter kids did in the first movie. But then again, yeah. I was colored by the fact that I'd read the books at the time, so it's hard to compare.
Yeah, it's very hard because, you know, this is not based on any book.
Yeah.
You know, it's on its own. It's J.K. Rowling's first script. So you never can compare, oh, you know, the book to this. There is no book to this.
Yeah.
And the thing I like about this, is the best part for me for Fantastic Beasts is, you know, it leads up to an introduction chapter to see probably better, you know, greater things down the road.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think it sets the table nice?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It does.
It has that introductory chapter.
Yeah. And one of the other reasons why I might be looking at this a little differently than you guys is because I did just complete my fourth column on the DCEU. If you guys haven't read it yet, I finally am continuing that series. And in that, you know, when I was doing my research for it, you know, there's this Forbes report from a while back that points to the fact that, you know, Warner Brothers was in a similar sort of spot where after Man of Steel came out, they were happy, but they weren't over the moon. Because they were hoping for something like the numbers that the Batman movies, you know, that the Nolan Batman movies were doing. And this didn't really do that. And actually, when adjusted for inflation, when you look at the domestic hauls for Man of Steel and Superman Returns, there was only a $36 million difference. So there was talk in a report that basically they looked to like that's why they got so excited when Snyder mentioned bringing Batman into the fray, because Batman was their box office champ at the time, and that's why they went, instead of Man of Steel 2, they went Batman v Superman route. And just to me, that looks a little similar to what's going on with Warner Brothers again with this, where it's like they're happy with the numbers, they wish they were better, and that's why for the sequel they're going to bring in a box office champ to really sort of try to, like, you know, drive this thing out, you know, over the wall. You know, So in that case, it was let's bring in Batman. In this case, it's let's bring in, you know, the Harry Potter mythology in a major way.
You know, I think
that's just the parallel I'm seeing.
The big difference for me, I think, is the fact that you have J.K. Rowling attached, and, you know, she's, you know, that's her world.
This is her world.
You don't fuck around with that. Yeah. Like, I think you could only push her so far. Maybe you could, like you said, drop hints, say, oh, this could be good. This could be good. And she could agree. But I don't necessarily think she will allow this to jump the shark in a big way.
Okay.
That's my thoughts.
Listen, I hope you're right. That's, you know, that's on my wish list as well. So I'm with you there.
All right. So, well, that was a very long discussion. Very good one, but we're moving on to a little movie called Deadpool. A couple weeks back, it was announced that Tim Miller had departed the project and it left it directorless. So the studio had to look for a director and they have found one. It was the hottest director to be rumored, David Leitch, co-director of John Wick, is now officially the director of Deadpool 2. How does this news strike you, Kelvin?
It's not surprising at all. I mean, I like John Wick a lot, the first one. And it's sort of, you know, sort of something that Deadpool 2 would see, you know, in the sequel. I mean, it all depends on how he executes the film. You know what I mean? But we'll just have to wait and see. And also the script.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not worried about the script because, you know, you got Reese and Wernick back working on it. You got, you know, obviously Ryan Reynolds is very involved. So it's going to be the same creative team. So for me, when I heard this news, it's very like it's a very sort of open and shut topic for me.
Yeah.
Good. You know what I mean? It sounds like, all right, good. Yeah. This is what they want. They wanted a young action director who would basically sort of follow their lead. That's exactly what David Leitch is. He even has like a similar sort of background to Tim Miller, where he worked behind the scenes for a very long time, you know, doing stunts and other sort of action-oriented stuff before he became a director on John Wick. And same thing, you know, Miller worked on visuals and special effects and all that sort of stuff, and then they hired him to make the first Deadpool. So this seems very much like they're following the same mold, where they want like a young, you know, not necessarily like genetically young, but young to the world of directing type of filmmaker, so that who will basically just take their ideas and put them into visual form. So to me, this is very like open and shy. I read this, I'm like, okay, good. You know, let's the John Wick guy, you know, yeah, like that's good. There's not a whole lot to sink our teeth into here. It seems like that's what they wanted. That's exactly what they got, and Leitch fits the bill.
Yeah, they had a visual void that they needed to fill, and he was the perfect contender for that. But I think another somewhat big takeaway from this is the report stating that they are looking to okay production for Deadpool 3. And they are also looking to get a completely different director for that one as well. So basically, this sets a precedent that it will not necessarily be a director-heavy, you know, series. It will be a Ryan Reynolds joint for all intents and purposes. And it's almost like, this is the way I see it, kind of like a Marvel movie or a more generic Marvel movie, where it's like they have the vision of the studio. Obviously, the director plays a big role, but his vision has to be in sync with the people up top, a.k.a. Ryan Reynolds and the writers, before they're able to move forward.
Yeah, yep, I think you hit the nail on the head. This is, you know, just like with the departure of Tim Miller, you know, they want the director to be not much of a factor. So if you have a director and now he's going to be there for every installment, then, you know, he becomes part of, you know, the nucleus. And it seems like Reynolds, Wernick, and Reese would rather, like, they remain the nucleus and they'll just keep hiring people who can do cool visuals and action for every movie.
And we'll see if that's a bad approach. Like, maybe it'll work out really well. But, like, okay, yeah, good job. But until then, we will have to wait and see, because we'll have to see just how much of a pull Tim Miller had in, you know, making that movie not terrible.
Yeah.
I think they saw Deadpool and the similarities that John Wick character had, because they have some sort of similarities.
I'm ready to see some gung fu in Deadpool.
Exactly.
So excited for that. So a lot of fun will be had, hopefully. This is just another wait and see situation.
Yeah.
Speaking of
waiting, the hiring is a very like open and shut case. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, it's good news. It's good news for sure. I don't think anyone is going to be complaining about this. Let's just hope the story's in place. All right, so Kelvin, you came in with some interesting news regarding Rogue One. Do you want to talk about that?
No. Yeah, of course. A couple of minutes before we started the podcast, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who lives in California, and he basically wanted to know if anybody knew when Rogue One tickets go on sale. And I knew that the tickets in Europe went on sale yesterday, right? I mean,
yeah, I believe it was yesterday.
Yesterday, right? So then he was like, well, if you want to know, the tickets go on sale December 1st, because there's a theater there, Hawkins 18 Theater in Chino Hills, California. They told him that they will start selling the tickets December 1st. So there you have it.
Cool.
All right. Looks like December 1st.
But the question now becomes December 1st. Compared to The Force Awakens, which was
October
20th, 2 months before the movie came out.
What do we think that means? That's something we were talking about before the podcast started recording a little earlier today. And we decided, you know what? Let's save this for the podcast. Let's let our listeners listen and weigh in via Twitter if they would like. Do you think this means anything? The fact that The Force Awakens went on sale a full 2 months. You know, that one came out, I believe, December 19th.
21st.
And tickets went on sale. Did it? Okay.
No. Actually, nope. That's a lie. December 18th. My bad.
18th, and tickets had gone on sale October 20th, so almost a full 2 months before they opened up the pre-sales. And yeah, I think I remember, like, it crashed Fandango. It was this huge fucking thing. I remember, like, my wife was up till 1 in the morning. I was in London at the time, so my wife had to be the one to do it, and she was up till like 1 in the morning on a work night trying to get us the tickets, and she did succeed because she's awesome. But yeah, so that was 2 months in advance, and now the Rogue One is not going to go on sale till 2 weeks in advance. What do you guys think? Does this say anything about Lucasfilm's confidence in Rogue One?
I'm going to let you answer that one first, Kelvin.
I don't know. I mean, compared to, I mean, the only reason I can see the difference of ticket sales 2 weeks compared to 2 months is because the other one, The Force Awakens, is literally a sequel from the last film, the last original trilogy.
Yeah.
So obviously a mass of fans were going to go see that because it's, you know, it connects to the Skywalker, like what we were talking about earlier. And this one doesn't, you know? Mm-hmm. So this one's just, you know, a
so you think they're just nervous prequel. About that. And then they're nervous about the impact that's going to have on ticket sales.
So I don't know if they're nervous, you know, I don't think so.
You just so you, all right. So you think maybe
that's the reason they did it 2 months in advance. There's more of a fan base to the original trilogy than there would this one.
I mean, I think you could also argue that people were more pent up and ready to go for Star Wars: The Force Awakens. But we had a Star Wars movie less than a year ago. In addition, this is a movie that does not relate to the overall plot or the saga rather. That we left off with last time. So are you saying they didn't see – do you think maybe they waited because there wouldn't be as much demand? Do you think they were worried about news about ticket sales not being as good as last year, potentially hurting the film? Like, for example, if they came out, you know, October 20th of this year and
it didn't sell out.
It gets a quarter of the sales of, you know, The Force Awakens. Does that have the potential for bad news? Like, are they being really protective of this because of its lack of ties to – the main saga? Do you see any move from Disney that or Lucasfilm that indicates any trepidation towards this film?
No.
Okay, well, there you heard it. So as of right now, it doesn't. Do you think? I guess I'll ask you, Mario.
I don't know if it's they're scared or anything. I really don't, but the answer would probably come when the next Star Wars film comes out, which is related to the original trilogy. Would they sell those tickets 2 months in advance again? You know what I mean?
Right. Or not. Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of.
Are they going to sell now? How about this? Do you think they'll sell the Han Solo film 2 months in advance because it says Han Solo?
Yeah, that is sort of the big difference. Is Rogue One really is the huge experiment here? Like, yes, it has Darth Vader. Yes, it does tie into the A New Hope in a way. Like, it's basically the opening screen crawl, the text crawl for that. But you know, it doesn't have the recognizable aspect of it. It doesn't have, you know, Luke or, you know, Han Solo in it and all that. So it really is the big experiment. It seems like the potential future of the spin-off films sort of hinges on the success of Rogue One. Even though Rogue One has connections, they aren't as apparent as, you know, Han Solo. So I think the performance of this movie is really important in that it can dictate whether or not they can start delving into truly unknown territory. And I'm wondering if they're trying to gear themselves up for as much success as possible by not giving them chances to fail and by potentially having the box office – or not the box office – having tickets go on sale a couple months early. They're giving an open window for doubt, and they don't want to allow that.
And not only that, what's going to be interesting is to read the awareness when it comes out, you know?
And what do you see the awareness as, you personally?
I don't know. I mean – you won't know until like 2 weeks before the film comes out.
Yeah.
You know, so that's when you'll know the awareness of people, you know, percentage, who's going to go see it, who's interested, who's not. You know, it's pretty interesting, that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. All right.
I get the feeling, but I actually haven't weighed in yet. I kind of threw it to you guys. I kind of get the feeling that they're a little anxious about this movie. I get the feeling that Oh, fuck, I lost my train of thought. You guys were talking for so long, I lost what I was going to say.
My bad.
No, listen, it's fine. I like listening to you guys. You tell a very fascinating yarn. But, you know what? I think about those comments that came out several months ago where, you know, they're definitely not expecting Force Awakens types of numbers with this. And we know the whole thing about the extensive reshoots. I kind of just get the sense that, you know, there is a little bit of concern, and that's why they're doing things like this. I think, you know, I mean, listen, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope that the movie's awesome. But I just can't shake this feeling that they're anxious about Rogue One coming out and not doing so well.
Okay, well,
we shall see.
Moving on from Rogue One to another spinoff story, Mario, you wrote something up about Han Solo today about what type of movie it's going to be. Do you want to fill in our listeners?
Yes, sir. So as you guys know, these extended universe movies, these, you know, these spinoff, standalone Star Wars stories, whatever the fuck you want to call them, movies, they're all supposed to, you know, in theory, they're supposed to take us into new unexplored territory, which, you know, we've already discussed ad nauseum here that they haven't gone far enough from the main canon yet. But, you know, at the very least, we know that these movies want to check out different genres. And we already know about the genre for Rogue One, which is more of like a war movie. And you know, Kathleen Kennedy even said it's more of like, you know, she specifically said it's like a World War II movie. When it comes to Han Solo, we got some concrete description here from Kennedy as to what sort of genre it's going to be. She told Variety that, you know, the Han Solo movie moves closer to a heist or Western type feel. And she mentioned, you know, the paintings of Remington and, you know, his primary colors that are used in his paintings defining the look and feel of the film. So something a little more colorful, Western, heisty. So that seems to be what Han Solo is going to be.
Love it.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like exactly the kind of movie I would expect a scoundrel like Han Solo to be involved in. So, you know, that sounds cool to me. And for me, one of the elements that I loved about A New Hope and what I loved about, like, the scene at the cantina in Mos Eisley is that, you know, that Star Wars, you know, always had that sort of space Western element, mm-hmm. even though it was all like intergalactic and you had the aliens and the, you know, flying through space and all that sort of shit and the Jedi. There was always sort of an element there of like that space Western feel that Han Solo really brought to it with his gunslinging ways, with the gun on, you know, with the holstered gun and, you know, killing Greedo and all that sort of shit. So the fact that they're going to go like full-fledged in that direction for this sounds exciting to me. So I'm down for a Western slash heist Han Solo movie. What do you think, Kelv?
Well, no, I mean, it's no surprise because a long time ago when I had known about, you know, the Han Solo film and I mentioned to you guys that the early script had Boba Fett in it.
Yeah.
It was a Western type of thing.
Okay.
It was a Western influenced film that shows you the rivalry between these two characters. So mm-hmm. to me, when they said that, I'm like, oh, that's all fucking news. I already knew
that. Yeah.
You know, so,
okay.
You know, let's see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just happy to hear this news in general. Like, yeah, we probably heard it before, but I guess having it driven home again and again.
Yeah, back directly then, from Kathleen Kennedy's mouth.
Right, and not only that, but also between when you read the script and now, it's been, you know, however long it's been, and things change.
I just hope that they still have Boba Fett in it.
I don't want to see Boba Fett. I'm over that guy. I really don't want to see any other ties to the universe. It just, I'm sick of links. We've said this before, but yeah, I just don't want to see it. But
they end up happening.
Well, yeah, but hopefully in the future, they will start to deviate from it. Because I don't.
By the way, I need to share something with you while we're on this topic.
Yes.
I had a baked epiphany while watching Doctor Strange that pertains to this. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Oh, shit.
Now, when I say baked, you know, we partook of some of the green leaf before Doctor Strange because I thought it would help enhance the trippy visuals. And
did it?
I had an aha moment while watching the trailer for Rogue One that played before Doctor Strange. And this might be obvious, and I might be making a big deal over Dick right now, but it felt like an earth-shattering revelation that night. for probably a variety of reasons. But when I was watching Rogue One, I realized something. They are going to address or retcon or finally fix one of the dumbest things about A New Hope. So for years and years and years, whenever people would talk about the Death Star and the fact that it had this stupid vulnerability, this fucking area there that you could drop the torpedoes down and it would blow up the whole thing, people always thought, wow, that was really stupid. You know, like, there's been all kinds of mockery, be it Family Guy, be it Robot Chicken, be it anyone who makes fun of things has pointed to the fact that why would the Death Star have this one fairly obvious vulnerability, considering, you know, what it was capable of and how much was supposedly involved in it.
Wait. I know what it is. I'm going to spoil it. Do you want me to just fuck you and just take it? I'm going to do it. I'm
curious. I was going to say it. All right, this fine, is my epiphany. Let me share it.
While looking let him at have his moment, goddammit.
While watching the latest Rogue One trailer.
Mads Mikkelsen character does it on purpose.
Yes. You're a son of a bitch. You're a son of a bitch. Yes, Jyn Erso's father, Mads Mikkelsen's character, he left that there so that the rebels could destroy the Death Star. Since he's basically like a double agent, they forced him to design the thing, but he purposely left this so that the rebellion could destroy this death machine. When I realized that, my head fell off. I'm like, oh shit, they're gonna finally address that, because that's always been such like a silly little black eye when it comes to that movie, where it's just like, you know, if you have this huge space station that you're gonna use to rule the galaxy, why would you leave this fucking obvious vulnerability? But it's because the guy who designed it was secretly working for the rebellion. That's fucking brilliant.
As poetic as that is, I'm gonna shit on your cereal, and I'm gonna say that doesn't explain.
Fuck up your footy pebbles.
That does not. That does not explain Return of the Jedi's flaw.
Yeah, like why was it still there?
Yeah,
but remember though, because it's not the same flaw. Remember, they had to go like into it, right to the reactor at the center of the thing. It was much, much harder in Return of the Jedi.
All right.
You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
I mean, it was harder, but.
It was much harder. So it's like they did learn from the mistake. And the only reason they were even get there, they were able to get there, because remember that new Death Star wasn't finished yet. So they, you know, so it was a vulnerable space station when they went at it the second time around. But
true.
Even with it being vulnerable, it was much tougher. So no, you didn't shit my pebbles. You just turned it into Cocoa Pebbles, and that shit's delicious.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. I'll be on board with that one, but.
Hey,
no,
come on, Star Wars fans. Do you realize that tweet at me about this? Is it dawning on you that Rogue One is going to finally address that silly little hole in George Lucas's A New Hope?
What are you going to do if it doesn't address those?
I think it already did, though, because the fact that we know that he's basically a double agent, I'm like, of course he did that on purpose. I think it's amazing.
I think High Mario or Baked Mario has his has his moments, and I think this is one of them.
Dude, I had an amazing epiphany, and I can't wait to be proven right.
All right.
But then again, I might be too stoned when I see Rogue One to even notice, so who knows?
All right, well, let's move on to a couple of trailers. We had a couple last week drop. One of them was in the form of a little Netflix series called A Series of Unfortunate Events. This has been I wouldn't say hotly anticipated, but people who enjoyed the books, you know, they got their fill in the movie with Jim Carrey, which was sort of like an amalgamation of all the books kind of combined, except mostly it relied heavily on the first one for the most part. Anyways, they've expanded it into a more faithful series for Netflix, starring Neil Patrick Harris as the uncle, whose name I forget. What
Count
did you think?
Olaf.
Count Olaf. What did you think of this Count trailer, Olaf. Marty? I know you've read these books.
Yeah, I read all the books when they originally came out. I was a fan at the time. Well, that's the thing. Like, I liked the first 20 seconds because it had a more sort of like awkward, darkly comic tone. Mm-hmm. And then as the trailer wears on, it gets just more and more outright sort of goofy and over the top funny. And, you know, I can't say that it's going to be good or bad based on that, but it just looks like they did sort of tweak the tone, because the books themselves were a lot more, they're much British, You're much more British. They're much British. You mean like the humor? It was much more like dry, and sort of like darkly comic, and like the opening moments of the trailer where the guy tells them that their parents have perished, and then they're like it's basically just it was a very darkly humorous moment as they're like we know what perished means, and the guy just sort of smiles at them awkwardly. Like that to me felt very much like the books, but then from then on it just became a little more like over the top humor. And I found that to be a little disappointing because I liked the drier, darker humor. But that said, I'm going to check it out, and I like the cast a lot. The production value looks pretty off the hook, and in general, Netflix hasn't really steered me wrong with their TV series, so I'm definitely going to check this out when it comes out. But I will just say that the trailer, it starts off right, like exactly how I would imagine a Lemony Snicket show to start. But then, the tone really does devolve into just a much more over the top, goofy tone than I was expecting.
Did you see the movie with Jim Carrey?
I did.
What did you think of that?
I did. I mean, honestly, it's a little hazy to me. I saw it years ago and only once. I remember walking away thinking I liked it. I wanted to see more of it. And I was kind of disappointed that we never got to see the sequels because that was going to be a series, of unfortunate events. But it was going to be a series of films.
Was it?
And then it just... They wanted to make, I believe, a trilogy. They were going to condense all 12 or 13 books into three movies, more or less. That's why, like, the first one pulled from, like, books 1 through 4, and then the next one was going to pull from books 5 through 9. You know what I mean? Like, they were basically, they were going to try to make a few films out of it.
Right, right.
And ultimately, it was a non-starter for a franchise, and I found that to be disappointing. But then again, I have to admit, I can be sort of biased because I love Jim Carrey. And I was really, anytime I get to see him, I'm very excited. And I was, I was hoping to see more of him as Olaf. I thought that was some inspired casting, and I thought he did some good work with the role. But yeah, so I liked it. I don't remember a lot about it at this stage of the game because it has been like 9 or 10 years since I saw it. But I do remember feeling like the movie was closer to the tone of the books than this trailer for the series seems to be.
Kelvin, any thoughts?
Oh, I totally agree with you on that. Once I saw the trailer, I thought it was a little bit, like what you were saying, goofy and stuff like that. Unlike the movie, which I also liked.
Yeah.
I was hoping to see a sequels. Was a much darker tone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
which is maybe why it didn't work. Maybe that's why they changed the tone.
It was a dark tone and a kind of like a fucked up tone too. You felt bad for these kids. So and this one, it doesn't seem like that. It looks like it's a goofy and it's jokes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that I don't like about that trailer, the one that just came out like last week.
Yeah.
But I'll give it a shot. I'll check it out. It's nothing wrong with it. Let's see what's up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read the first couple books. They weren't really my thing, but I understand the appeal for sure. And by not my thing, I means that I, picked them up like 5 years ago and realized I'm not it wasn't what I wanted to read in this moment of my life.
Yeah.
It aimed too low as far as like the age demo, which is nothing against it, but that's just how I feel.
No, it's a bit simplistic. And look, my kids, Mario said that he read all the books. My oldest son read all the books as well, and he loved the first one. When he saw this one, he was like, is this like a series of a joke or something like that? He didn't like it either. So
all right, so
Looking at it. I'm looking at it through my son's point of view, because remember, he grew up with the Potter books and the Lemony Snicket books and some other books that he's been reading. But I usually take his word for it and what he sees, because nowadays PR firms and studio, his age is what they're looking for, his age group.
What's his age group?
So he's 21.
Okay.
And they look at age groups between 17 to 34, sometimes maybe 44. But 17 to 34 is what they look at.
He wasn't that impressed.
He was not impressed, no.
Okay.
But
now, Jeb, you were saying, Jeb was in the middle of his response.
No, it's okay. Let him finish. It's fine.
No. Go ahead, Jeb. I'm done.
I don't know. Okay. Basically, God, what was I saying? I read the books, or I read a couple of the books, and, you know, it just wasn't my thing. But I did appreciate the dry tone, as you mentioned, like the really dark sense of humor that it had to it. Yeah. And the beginning of this trailer definitely had that. That being said, I wasn't completely against all the goofiness. One joke that really hit pretty well with me was the one with the hourglass, how he said when the sands run out, and then he leaves, then he comes back, he's like, I just bought this online. I didn't realize it went so quickly. Just tilted a few more times, and it's good. Like, I really liked that joke, and I'm okay with them adding things like that into it, and having it sort of have a lighthearted slash dark tone to it. But I hope it doesn't abandon the dark tone, and hopefully there is more of that in this TV show. I'm just wondering, personally, how they're going to divide up all the stuff. Like, is this going to be a multiple season show? Is it going to be like, is the first season, first few books?
I'm curious about that myself,
So that is sort of
I think they're waiting for it to be released and see what the...
Well, yeah,
that's the thing. Like, how do they construct the story? Does the story basically, like, by the end of the final episode, are they up to what the final book would be and they conclude it, or are they going to leave it open ended so that it could go on for more? Yeah, you know, that's one of the interesting questions that comes up when you're adapting a book series into a TV series. Mm-hmm. You know, so if they are being faithful to the books, will this first season basically just be all 12 or 13 books in a nutshell, or are they going to just tell some of the stories and keep some in their back pocket for future seasons?
Do you see how do you see this, Mario? Do you think it would work best as a single season or a few seasons based on your knowledge of the books?
I would say 3 seasons.
Because the
I
books would say are
it
short.
It should be multiple seasons. I mean, yes, the books are short, but there's still like 13 different stories that they could expand upon there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, just because the books were short doesn't mean that they can't, you know, explore certain areas and flesh certain things out. So I think there's definitely enough places to go in terms of, from a storyline perspective, where they can get a few seasons out of this. So I kind of hope they do that. And it's not just like one 13 episode season that basically tries to tackle, you know, a book per episode.
I will say this. I think, as far as my TV diet goes, I have a lot of serious shows on it, and it will be nice to have something that's more lighthearted to, you know, that we can just sort of sit down and relax and watch. And I don't have nearly enough of those. So for that reason, I'm a bit happy to see this come up. Yeah. All right.
Let's see what happens. I mean, because it all depends on, the numbers, right? When Netflix gets their numbers.
Those very mysterious numbers that they go by.
I just love that you have like third party companies trying to find a way to steal like the information, you know, trying to find a way to make their own things, like basically turning into Nielsen ratings, except for Netflix. I think what they do is they like pay people to get, you know, allow them to track it and use that kind of like how Nielsen did with their boxes. And that's the only way we can get any semblance as to what Netflix is doing. Anyway, I just think that's interesting. All right.
Yeah. So, and by the way, and one thing is similar to what I did earlier where I sort of clarified because it sounds like I'm shitting on something. Like I did it with Fantastic Beasts, even though I wasn't really shitting on it. With this too, like I liked the trailer. I was entertained by it and I'm going to see it. To me, just, you know, just to sort of concisely put a face on my issue is that I, you know, prefer the drier British tone. And this looks like if you listen to like Jammer's description of that joke, this is more like American broad humor. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that it just basically surprised me. But that said, just because it surprised me and it's not what I expected doesn't mean that I don't think it looks good. I actually, I do think it looks good. Just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Is the author British?
I used to know a lot about him back when I was in the middle of reading the books. I forget.
Okay, I'm looking up right now. Daniel Handler is one of the authors, and he's American. And so is Brett Helquist, and he's also an American. Oh, he's an illustrator. Okay, so it looks like it's American.
So it is. Okay.
Okay, cool. It's American.
But it definitely had a very British, you know, vibe and energy to it. You guys have to it.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
All right.
Really quick, I want to clarify. I think the reason why is it very much has sort of a similar tone to the Roald Dahl books, which are British.
I've never read those.
You never read a fucking Roald Dahl book?
Nah.
What?
Nah, I only read LRM online.
Charlie
really...
and the Chocolate Factory, the BFG, Matilda. I that was my movies. Shit.
I don't read no books. What is this?
Yeah, okay. Moving on to the final topic of the day as far as news goes, we got a Kong Skull Island trailer. This is a movie that I was not expecting to like. I remember they announced it, and I kind of got my fill with the Peter Jackson movie. I really didn't want to see more Kong. Godzilla, while I enjoyed it, I really didn't care for the human stuff. The whole idea just didn't really excite me that much to have him team up with Godzilla. None of it really excited me. And then San Diego Comic-Con came along. We got our first taste in a teaser, and I was kind of sold based on the idea solely that King Kong would be gigantic. And then we got this trailer, and I fucking loved everything about this trailer. It's sort of the fun Hollywood tone. It's like, for me, when I think of Hollywood blockbusters, this is kind of the tone I'm getting. Sort of playful, yet, you know, action-packed and serious and, you know, just interesting. And this delivered on all fronts. John C. Reilly, I thought, was a great character based on the trailer. He seemed funny, yet, you know, he looked like he'd be serious at times. I like the conflicting goals between John Goodman and the rest of the cast. I liked that one shot of that guy's aviators and all the explosions. I thought that was cool. The sort of Vietnam-esque type of tone it was going for. Like, everything about it just, I thought, was very well done, and I'm hoping it's indicative of what we get. And Kong being a giant guy and not being the bad guy of this movie will, I think, work into making it interesting as to who we want to win when he takes on Godzilla, because Godzilla was also treated similarly to where he wasn't the bad guy. So those are my quick thoughts. Mario, what did you think?
I enjoyed the fuck out of that trailer, man. I really did. I pretty much didn't care about this movie until I watched the trailer. You know, and that's the thing. I really enjoyed the Peter Jackson Kong for what it was. I really enjoyed the period trappings of it and how, like, historically accurate he recreated New York and how it was a more contemplative movie about, you know, man and nature and who's really the beast and whatever. It was a heady movie. And I think it's one of the reasons why it didn't do, you know, it was a more complicated pill for people to swallow. This one looks more just like balls to the wall, fun blockbuster action movie. And in that respect, it also makes it seem less like it's repeating itself. You know what I mean? Because I was nervous. I'm like, hey, you know, we've already been here and done. The fact that the tone itself is so drastically different and that they seem to be trying to court a totally different type of audience, I think sets this apart from Jackson's recent reboot, which isn't even recent anymore. But, you know, I feel like it's still in people's minds.
12 years.
And it's still one of those things, though, that made this feel a little bit like, really, we're doing this again?
Yeah.
But now that I've seen the trailer and I see where they're actually going with it, I'm actually, like, sold as fuck. It looked fun. It looked funny. It looked like it's going to be fairly awe-inspiring to watch Kong fuck shit up. He's huge, like you said. And I am very curious to see how they're going to set up the Godzilla thing. I'm willing to put money on it now that, like, Godzilla won't be addressed really in the movie, but that by the end, like, there's going to be like a coda, like an end credit sequence that, you know, basically implies that Godzilla is on the horizon. But yeah, no, I'm way, way in. Although, hang on, now that as I'm speaking about it, I do have a question. I wonder what you guys think. In terms of the timeline, is it possible that this is a prequel to Godzilla?
Yes.
The reason I ask is because
it is. It's in the 70s.
Okay. Oh, so that's right. That should have been obvious to me. Duh. Okay, and they have the fucking Creedence Clearwater Revival music playing. So this is Vietnam era. Perfect. Okay. Yeah, the reason I'm just thinking out loud is because when Goodman said the thing about, like, proof that monsters exist, I'm like, don't we already know that if this is the same world Godzilla was in? But yes, so this is 40 years ago. Gotcha. Never mind. You answered my question. I love you, Los Fanboys, for the win.
Kelvin, what do you think?
I thought it was great, dude. I mean, I'm extremely happy for my buddy Jordan White Roberts, who is the director. He's a friend of mine, and I'm extremely happy to see that he's gone, you know, this high now. I don't know if you guys saw The Kings of Summer. I thought that was a nice movie.
I did not.
And then from him to go from an indie film to this was a big, you know, jump. But I like the action. I like the cast. And it also, I don't know, the opening scene when the helicopter is going towards a cloud and stuff like that, it kind of reminded me of the, I mean, I grew up in watching the 1976 Kong. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's my favorite one. And it sort of reminded me of that. You know, you have the blonde girl, you have the guy, you have, like, in other words, like Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange. So it reminded me a lot of it. And it's going back to, you know, the Vietnam days, and this Kong, the one that I grew up was in 1976 or on the same area. And the fact that he's tall as fuck, you know, I don't know.
What do you mean he had to be?
When you see the handprint on the fucking rock.
Yeah.
And I think they made it that tall. So he, well, obviously, you know, there's going to be Godzilla in it somehow. That's why they made him that tall, so he can be toe-to-toe with Godzilla.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because even he, in the size he is now, I think he's still maybe a third the size of Godzilla, but he has the potential to still, like, jump around, you know, and, you know, fuck him up a bit. So it'll be interesting to see that fight. But, yeah.
I mean, I'm all game for that, for the this kind, to see how, you know, like, again, I grew up in the 76 one. This reminded me of it with Jessica Lange as the girl. And Brie Larson is this one, and Viola, and they say the same guys who were in the island, same guys that were in 1976 Island. So it reminded me a lot. So I'm interested in this for sure.
Yeah, and I wasn't before. I really wasn't.
Yeah, and one thing go ahead.
No, no, I was saying why not for Mario.
I don't know. I just, you know, like, I feel, again, when it comes to Kong, it's another one of those where, like, just to me, it feels like been there, done that, you know? So it wasn't really on my radar at all until I saw this trailer.
Yeah, that was the same for me until San Diego Comic-Con, where we got our first taste of that, and I was sold then, and this did not disappoint. But one thing I do want to say in regards to the director, I think he went on the record saying that he was kind of – didn't want – the film to have that same formula to where we don't see the monster for most of the movie. And then in the third act, we see him. And in this trailer kind of followed that, where it's like, bam, right off the bat, fucking Kong is right there.
There he is in all his glory, you walking around.
Yeah, exactly. You see him walking around, and then you realize, like I said, he's not necessarily the bad guy. And I'm really interested to see how he works with the humans on the island to defeat the skull crawlers, as they were called by John C. Reilly. So, yeah.
And tell me, do you think they're going to go that route that we've seen before, and, like, actually in Godzilla movies specifically, where maybe some of this is man-made, like it's some sort of commentary? Because I just I kind of got that sense when they were showing how the island was getting bombed in the beginning, like the government was using the island to, like, test out bombs and shit. Do you think they're going to try to pull something where it's, like, you know, radioactive stuff from the bombs is why these creatures are growing so big and mutating the way they are?
No, I think I think the idea behind it was that they knew that these monsters were here, and they wanted to sort of get an idea of the lay of the land of the island. And I think they justified in a stupid way, kind of basically saying those bombs were kind of like some weird way to map the island. I don't know how that works, but that's what I got from the trailer. So I feel like they knew the monsters were there. They were wanted to explore. That was sort of a preliminary way for them to explore. And the existence of the monsters has nothing to do with humans. That's my thought.
Yeah, okay. I kind of hope I hope you're right, because I'm kind of like, we've gone down that road already too many times in these kinds of movies where it's like, yes, we get it. The nuclear bombs made the monsters, and humans are assholes for messing with nukes. I got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping they didn't go that route. So I hope you're right.
All right, so those are my final thoughts on the trailer. But I want to bring something back, because we were given a message on one of our posts last week. We missed the trailer,
guys. Oh, yeah, we really did.
We missed the trailer. Like, I guess
we're in, like, 3 weeks late now.
In the throes of our discussion last week, which escaped me. I don't even know what we were talking about. We were talking about some movie for half the time, and we did not cover the Wonder Woman trailer, which dropped, like you said, 3 weeks ago. And I think we don't necessarily need to go in depth with it, but I do want to get your general perceptions of this trailer that we got. Mario, do you want to start us off?
I really liked it. I got a real kick, and I did write like a standalone piece on this, where I really got a kick out of the reference to Superman in the movie, in the middle when she protects him in the alley, and she's wearing the hat and the glasses, and it's a very, very clear homage and allusion to Richard Donner Superman the movie and Christopher Reeve. Mm-hmm. And to me, that sort of signaled the fact that this movie is going to have some serious heart to it. It's going to have, you know, it's going to have some like reverence for the comics and the heroes. And yeah, just to me, it seems like a movie that's more sort of that speaks to me than like one of these sort of dark, you know, deconstruction of our heroes type movies that we've been seeing lately. So to me, it hit all the right notes. It looks like it's fun. It looks like it's going to have some action and some adventure, a very interesting hero at the center of it all. It's a period piece, which I'm excited to see. You know, World War One is not a period that we see a lot in movies. It's usually always World War Two. So, I thought the most recent trailer was pretty damn solid.
Yeah, I really liked it too. This is sort of a stark contrast to my thoughts on the San Diego Comic-Con trailer, which, while, you know, I understand why they made it the way it was, I really didn't give a shit about the characters. It was mostly Wonder Woman power sliding all over the place. And, you know, action scenes. And I'm like, I get it. Why you're trying to sell the action. I get it. I just don't care. Like, you have to make me care about what's going on screen. And that trailer did not. This one did. I got an idea for who she was. We got a little bit of comedy here and there, a little character stuff between her and Chris Pine. And, you know, it was just enough. It wasn't too much. It was just enough for me to say, okay, these guys have some personality. This is kind of how the story's going to go, how it's going to play out. And these are why they're fighting, blah, 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 blah. So it was just enough to entice me with enough action to, you know, make it sort of a big blockbuster type of movie. And I was digging it. What about you, Kelvin?
I dug it. I mean, I like what Mario wrote about the reference to Superman. But I dug it, dude. At the end of the day, I just want to see how, you know, this all comes together. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The DCEU. But I dug it. I dug it very much. You know, there's nothing else really I can say about it, because I totally, you know, I haven't seen that trailer since the day it came out.
Right. You know. Okay, cool. Well,
but there were some, you know, cool looking action scenes that I pretty much enjoyed.
All right. Well, we're just on the tail end of the episode, but before we go, I do want to check back in our weekly segment of what we're watching. Yeah, this is a sort of rundown of TV shows or movies that we saw recently that have caught our interest in the past week. Kelvin, do you have anything to share?
I watch a lot of shit, dude. I'm still watching The Exorcist, which this shit is so good. Nice. That shit is good.
I gotta see that, man.
Dude, it's good. Especially, you know, a Latino priest. You know how we do. You know how we do.
Santeria, brujería.
Oh, yeah, boy. A priest? I like women. Fuck it. You know, and you'll see what I mean when you see it. But I'm watching that. Like I said last week, I watched The Crown, which was surprisingly fucking good. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, really, really good. What else am I watching? And the usual, you know, The Walking Dead.
Snore.
Snooze fest so far. I mean,
American Horror Story finished last week.
Yeah, I didn't like the ending too much. I liked the horse. Yeah, it was all right. What
I'm
else?
Caught up on.
I'm caught up with The Flash. I'm caught up with The Flash. I haven't seen one episode of Legends of Tomorrow. I'm two episodes behind on Supergirl, which I really don't care anymore after Superman left, but that's about it, really.
Mario,
and I have not watched since Ghost Rider,
Agents
Marvel's
of Shield.
Agents of Shield. Yeah,
Mario, you said American Horror Story. You're not caught up yet.
Actually, that one I am caught up on. It's Westworld and Walking Dead that I'm not caught up on.
What
yet.
Did you think of American Horror Story's ending?
I was fucking surprised that it's over already. Like,
me too.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Don't they usually do one of those wraparound things where, like, we get like 8 or 9 episodes and then they go on a break and come back in February? The fact that it's already done, I'm like, oh shit. Was like, I didn't see it actually coming.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere. And I think it was a bit of a weak ending. I liked episodes 5 through 9, but 10 was okay.
Yeah. I was about to get to that part. Like, A, I was shocked that it was already over. And B, I thought it was kind of just ho-hum on the end there.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, like you said, episodes 5 through 9, I thought, oh, shit, this season is awesome. And then it just kind of ended on a whimper. And it wasn't even particularly scary.
Yeah, and so, it got to the point where it's like another group of people are filming the house. And I'm like, God damn, these people never learn. I wanted, like, 18 other freaking people going to that house and getting killed. Like, I'm done. Like, I think you've rounded that corner a bit too many times.
Yeah. And that's something that my buddy Jeremy Scully, who actually writes for the site, but he covers comic book news. That's something he's always said about the American Horror Story, that, like, their seasons always kind of, like, they end on a whimper. A lot of times, like, they'll get really hot there in the middle somewhere and then just sort of die off at the end. And I think, true to form, you know, in his eyes, this one also just kind of ended on, like, oh, all right, I guess if that's what we're doing.
I mean, I think that's why horror movies are, you know, they're mostly horror movies, not as many horror TV shows. It's hard to sustain that feeling of you know, fear, I guess, for a long period of time. And the only reason Stephen King's books can do it is because generally most of the time it's not even a horror book. Generally, like, 70% of it is just character building, and then there's sort of the scary stuff, you know, sprinkled throughout.
Yeah. Those now, listen, I have to do something a little bit different and unprecedented right now.
Okay.
I have to get going.
Okay.
So I'm going to let you guys wrap this puppy up and let you come up with the question of the week. But I've actually got a jet. I've got a little girl that's about to get out of school.
All right. While you do that, I have a couple more things to say then before we head out. So take it easy and we'll see you next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye. All right.
So the other thing I watched the Suicide Squad extended cut.
I have...
You probably aren't going to like it. Here's the thing.
Yeah.
Suicide Squad, it did really well for me on one front, and that was the squad itself. I really liked the characters. I thought they were fun. I liked their personalities. I liked their interaction. This extended cut enhances that. It enhances a bit the relationship between Joker and Harley Quinn, and it does nothing to solve the underlying problems of the film, which lie in the plot, Amanda Waller's plan, and the villain, which are all weak as fuck. So if those were your problems with the movie, which they were for me, this does nothing to solve them, but it did make me like the characters a little bit more. So that's where I stand with that. Does not solve any problems. Probably not worth your time or money if you really didn't even like the first one, or the original. If you did like the theatrical release, you'll find more to like here. So
what about, how would you compare that extended cut to, like, Batman versus Superman?
Nothing at all the same. Batman v Superman solved a lot of its problems with that extended cut. This does not solve any problems. It just enhances what I thought was already relatively good, which is, you know, the character interactions. It does nothing to actually solve any problems. It is not the cut that we needed to see for this film at all.
All right, because I have no intentions of seeing it then.
Yeah, yeah. If you didn't like the theatrical cut, if that wasn't enough, you're not going to like this one. It's not really going to change your opinion. And like I said, the movie has some pretty glaring weaknesses, but I was able to overlook them because I still had a good time watching these guys interact with one another. And this amplified that a bit. But like I said, problems galore. So fuck it.
Yeah.
Finally, I got a chance to actually start watching House of Cards, which is a show that I have managed not to watch up to this point. And I'm hooked. You know, I'm about 4 episodes in. I'm like, damn, this is really good. I'm so happy that I waited all this time because I have a lot of content.
Isn't it great?
Oh, my God.
Great.
It's fucking awesome. I'm loving it so much. Just sort of
that for now is my favorite show as we speak right now. That's my number one show besides Homeland.
I just love the way they're able to show Frank Underwood play people. Like, how they make him seem like such a genuine person whenever he wants something. And, you know, it's hard to see him as a bad guy because he does all kinds of really good stuff, but just because he could twist it in his own self-interest. But that doesn't change the fact that he does a lot of good stuff. So it's just so interesting to me, like, just to see that play out.
He's evil and good at the same time.
Yeah. And
I love that he, you know, he's doing his stuff. Mm-hmm. He's talking to these senators or whatnot. And then he looks at you at the camera and he says, this motherfucker. I'm like, yo.
Yeah.
I like it. I love that part.
Oh, it's fantastic. You know? Like, he's like, all right, I'm going to get real with you guys now. And he starts talking what he's really thinking. And this is the perfect type of storytelling that I really love. The perfect type of convoluted, yet, you know, it talks to the audience so that it makes sure that we're keeping up to speed with what his intentions are, which is really important.
And I love that, you know, it shows you the inside of the politics.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? How that stuff
the
works.
The dirtiness, all that stuff.
Yeah. You know? So I'm really excited to keep watching it. Like I said, I'm thrilled that we see this because I have a lot of show to watch still. You know.
Dude, wait until you get to season 2.
Okay.
You know? Cool. Oh, the first episode on season 2, you'll be like, "What?" You know?
Looking forward to it. All right, well, that's pretty much all I've been watching. I saw Fantastic Beasts. We discussed that already. I finished
Luke Cage. Westworld. You up to date with Westworld?
I haven't started yet.
Oh, okay. I watched that also. I'm up to date with that, you know. So
I'm up to date with Supergirl.
I'm getting now why people like Westworld. In the first 2 episodes, I mean, I went to the premiere here in New York for Westworld. And, you know, when I went with my wife and my son, you know, they weren't jiving with it. And I get it, you know. But then after like 3 or 4 episode, you really get to like Anthony Hopkins' character and shit. It's really good, though.
Yeah, overall. It's definitely on my to-watch list. But like I said, I have so many serious shows to watch that.
Yeah, yeah.
By the time
that I'm looking forward to watching next is Taboo.
Which one is that?
That's the one with Tom Hardy.
Oh God, that looks so boring. I'm so worried about that being boring to me.
I want to see how that pans out.
That's FX, correct?
Yes, that's fine. Yep, yep.
Yeah, okay. Right now,
yeah, because I think a lot of these shows are dying out right now because of the season, the holiday season coming up.
Oh man, I've been pissed off because Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It seems like it's taken 7 weeks to get a new episode, and it's pissing me off.
Yeah,
like
it's you know, Thanksgiving weekend, and then after that, it's the whole, you know, Christmas vacation for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
I'm up to
at least you can catch up to shit that you haven't caught up to yet.
That is the one silver lining.
Exactly.
I'm caught up on Supergirl, which it started to kind of peter out, but it actually got a little better again. And I'm interested to see where that goes. Luke Cage, I just finished. And I think last week. Maybe I mentioned it last time. And I think it had a pretty strong ending to it. The ending episode reminded me a lot of Friday, how it sort of all ends in a fist fight. And I freaking loved it. It was awesome. And like how they're all gathering around. I was just like, okay, this is the perfect type of ending for this type of show. So I really enjoyed that one. I think it may be slightly below Daredevil season 2 as my favorite Marvel Netflix show so far.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely really good stuff. If you haven't checked it out, definitely check it out. And Gotham, I am a few episodes behind on.
I haven't seen that one episode yet.
Oh,
I have them all recorded, but you know.
Yeah, like it's doing okay. It's not terrible. It's entertaining to watch passively. It's become my show to watch when I'm not really paying attention, but I'm paying attention just enough to kind of see what's going on. But so it's not bad. If you're digging it, then you know I could see why. But if not, I could also see why. It's one of those I'm kind of indifferent towards.
Yeah.
And that's it. So, as far as the question of the week goes, I want to know your guys' thoughts on Fantastic Beasts. Should Warner Brothers be concerned? And do you think this move from them to tie things in more with Harry Potter is them panicking? Or do you think it was planned from the get-go or from, you know, months or years ago? So let us know. Hashtag Los Fanboys on Twitter. And of course, come to LRMonline.com for the latest in geek news, film, comics, all kinds of good stuff. We have features every week. You know, I'm posting a top 5 article later on today, as well as editorials on Thursdays. And so be sure to keep an eye out on those at LRMonline.com. So also, lastly, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. A 5-star review would be wonderful, and we will read your review aloud on the podcast as we did at the top of this episode. So thanks so much for everything, and we will see you all next week. Later.
Peace out. Peace out.